Pod. 22 Pod. In the city that sounds
nice. Huh. Hi, Harry.
Oh, how are you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, thanks. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm late.
No, it's all right. Give me some extra time to listen to your stuff.
It's that Saturday feeling.
Yes, unusual for me. That's never done one on a Saturday before.
Yeah, man. So you've been listening to my stuff. That's cool.
Yeah, I've been enjoying it. Feel like I've heard No Fools before, I think.
Yeah, that one's been out for a little while. I put that out in 2018. Just sort of threw it into the void.
And it's gone down well on Spotify by the looks of it, yeah.
It has, and like ironically, that was like a demo.
Right, okay.
I didn't really care for it, but then it got picked up by a Netflix show.
Right.
And okay. It was that kind of sparked the beginning of my release schedule.
Right, okay, cool.
It kind of gave me a kick up the ass, basically.
Yeah, it showed you it could be done kind of thing.
Yeah, and it showed me that I have I have a certain limitation on control of like what to put out and what not to. The fact that a demo got that many plays means that like I should just, you know, not overthink it so much and not be such a control freak.
Yeah, fair. I don't know I can't remember his name. Someone messaged me on Twitter, basically, the bit of info about you. Daniel, I think. So I've been checking out your Wikipedia and stuff. And
Daniel? Right,
yeah, he's called on Twitter, he's called Cut and Come Again.
I don't know.
Anyway. But yeah, on your Wikipedia, it says you spent your early years in Peru and Chile. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I was born in England and then we moved to Peru when I was 4.
Okay, right.
And then we moved to Chile and then moved back to Peru. And then there was like, there was sort of like a civil war going on and lots of bombs going off. Like I got this story about when I was like 5, I was like we lived in this flat in Miraflores, just like on the 15th floor, like on the coast of Lima. And my sister, who's 10 years older than me, went to get some bread from like the local supermarket. And I just remember like all the windows sort of moving and me playing my cousin, my mum, like picking us up and throwing us under the bed and everyone sort of screaming my sister's name. And then like a bomb had basically gone off in the supermarket. And 10 minutes later, after like just pure chaos, my sister comes back and like confused, like what's going on. And she'd basically forgotten that her favorite TV show, this soap opera called Queen of the Chat, Reina de la Chatarra, this Brazilian like soap opera, was on the TV. So she'd turn around and gone back home to watch the show, and it saved her life, basically.
Oh, so wow.
Like that was the last time we were in Peru for like till I was like 9, I think. And then I'd go there for holidays and stuff because my mum's Peruvian and most of my family there. I mean, my mum and dad live there now. But yeah, I moved around like eight different times before I was 12, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes,
but obviously that's a mad story. So you both grow up like bilingual then? That's quite useful, I guess.
Yeah, I'm one of 4, so I got a half sister who's on my dad's side, and she lives in France. And I got an older brother who's 13 years older, and my sister's 10 years older. But yeah, we're all bilingual.
Oh, cool! Yeah, always jealous of people that can speak but like multiple languages. Yeah,
yeah, man. And it helps, like even being in France or in Portugal, like you just sort of speak Spanish, but slowly. And they kind of understand what it is. They prefer it to you speaking them in English.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes. It's like you're trying a little bit harder.
Yeah, like South America is one place. I always hear how amazing it is, but I've just never managed to go yet. But I'll go at some point.
It's another world. Like, And it's got everything, you know, you've got the jungle, you've got the desert, you've got the city, you've got the sea, you've got the countryside. Like a lot of my family there just never leave because you don't really have to. And Peru is such a big country, it take a lifetime to sort of see everything. But yeah, and the food's amazing. And yeah, I miss it. But I'm, you know, really blessed and happy to be in London.
That yeah, feels yeah.
My home.
So like moving on to like the music side of things, like were you musical from a young age type of thing?
No, I loved music. Like my older siblings would listen to music all the time. So I have like early memories of like Prince and like Public Enemy, like playing in the house. And then by the time I was like 7, 8 or 9, I was listening. I remember one birthday I got given from my grandma, but my brother really bought the CDs. It was like Supergrass, In It for the Money. That album with Late in the Day on it, I think it's called In It for the Money. And like Dig Your Own Hole by Chemical Brothers. And I think like a Faithless record. But like I always loved, I think the first record I ever got was like Definitely Maybe. And I love Blur as well, and Pulp. Like me and my mate used to go back home after school and do these little like dances to like Common People and then get like our parents to come and watch us. And it's just like, even to this day, like how lyrically poignant is that song?
Ah, yes, yes, yeah.
Like no one's really been able to top that. It's like some Dylan or Wu-Tang shit. It's incredible. But I always loved music and I was surrounded by it. My dad played piano and guitar, so there was always like a piano and guitar around, but I never really picked one up. I was always like afraid of it, I guess. I always thought like, you know, it's such a simple looking thing, a guitar, but when you pick it up, it's just like a world in itself, a minefield. But I think I started getting lessons when I was like 16 at school. And it was just like quite, I don't know, it was quite jarring because they'd just be like, okay, here's a Guns N' Roses solo, like try and learn that. And you're like, what? And then my dad would also like give me his sort of strange lessons of, you know, he's a Beatles head and Buddy Holly head and early Dylan. So he'd just be like, all you need to know is like 5 chords and then you got it. But I think it really clicked when I was like 16 and I learned enough chords and I started playing with my, like one of my oldest friends, and we formed a band called the Eraserheads. But we started playing just like, cause he played drums and he needed a guitarist to play along to. And then eventually we got a bassist and started a band. But I felt like, or I like naturally sort of saw a pocket in between the drums of where like the guitar should go. And I don't think I could even play like power chords at the time. It was just like playing 3 notes. And yeah, like I think that kind of started something in my brain and like an obsession. And I never finished school. Like I dropped out when I was 17 to go to a music college with this guy that played drums. He was called Wim. And we went to college in Guildford and pretty much didn't attend the college, just like hung out as mall rats. And it was quite like, it was a college run by like ex-session musicians that played in like the support band for Saxon like 100 years ago.
Right.
And like they had weird lessons called like pre-production where they'd be like, they try and tell you what's cool. Like they'd show you like a video of like Blur playing on Jules Holland and be like, draw a circle and be like, this is the cool circle. And like, these guys are so uncool that it makes them cool. And you're just like, what the fuck? Like, this is insane. But I never actually got my degree for that, and neither did Wim, because we were recording our first like demo with my brother's friend who engineered for Paul Epworth at the time. So he was doing all the Future Heads and rapes and baby shambles demos with Paul.
Oh, amazing.
He's a guy called Adrian Newton. I owe a lot to him because he like got me into, he gave me my first like, the first, like he gave me like the first history lesson and like what I should be doing. Cause he like heard my, our style. He was right. You need to listen to Replacements. And he gave me like Decade by Neil Young, like this discography. And yeah, we were recording that in the studio. I can't remember what it was called. I think it was called 2 kHz. And it was on Harrow Road. And it backed onto this huge graveyard. And there's loads of like, when Baby Shambles were doing Kilimanjaro, like that was around the same time we were doing that. Cause I was remember listening to like The Man Who Came to Stay, Kilimanjaro. And I'd been aware of like, obviously like the Strokes and the Libertines and stuff, but I was more into like the New York scene from like 30 years before that, like Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, like Television, Richard Howe and the Voidoids. When I heard that, those Baby Shambles demos, I just was picturing like Richard Howe, like our Richard Howe, and like Patrick Warden was like the guitarist in that band. He's just that his guitar playing was just so incredible and so like fresh. That like, yeah, I got like kind of obsessed with Baby Shambles after that session. But our music never really like crossed. I think Eraserheads was always like sort of seen as a, I was kind of just wanted to be Kurt Cobain, basically.
Right.
I didn't really have any chops or any experience or any like sort of connection to myself to be able to like write songs. Like we just like jam, call it a song, and then play like new songs every gig, and it'd just be quite overwhelming. Like there was no like order to it. But yeah, to answer your question, I wasn't really music. I was just obsessed with music, with all sorts of music. And then I got into it. I got into playing when I was like 16. And I think it was probably because like a girl at school I wanted to impress.
But like, am I right in thinking you'd have been about 18 in 2004? So it's quite a good age for all this kind of scene kicking off, really.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we would... We'd come to London because I moved to London when I was like 18. But before that, we'd come to London and go to all those like Wow Wow raves in Woolworth Road in South London. And me and my friends were like obsessed with Ludes.
Right.
And like the whole Mystery Jets thing. And yeah, like Baby Shambles, there was a band called like 5 o'clock Heroes that would play a lot as well.
Yeah.
And we just get sort of, those nights were so fun. And then Frog started, which was like a big club night in the center of London, right by where the Astoria was, RIP. And there'd be every Friday night, and every Friday night you'd be guaranteed to see two great bands. There'd be one in the big room that had like released a record, or, and there'd be one in a small room that'd be kind of like an underground thing. And like my band Eraser had played there, but upstairs, which was the Young and Lost Room, which was a label run by these two girls, Sarah and Nadia at the time. And then Frog was run by all the guys that lived at above Nambuka, this pub in Holloway Road. And just everyone would just meet there. I mean, that was like our, I just watched Meet Me in the Bathroom last night. I went to the cinema to see it. But that was like our Misshapes, you know, our like club. But yeah, it was a really good time. And you know, I was thinking, I went to see it with my very old friend Emma yesterday, that movie, and it was like incredible dose of nostalgia, even though we weren't in New York at that time. But it's like, you know, I'm sure if you're like an old punk from like the late 60s or 70s in New York, watching that film would give you nostalgia. But for us, like being around 2004, 2005, 2006, going out, it's like that feeling of just like, it's a mess, but it's our mess. And it's just like, no one really cared so much about what was happening. You just like went and watched a band, had fun. And then like, if you got inspired enough, you started a band and you pushed it enough. And like, there wasn't all this like Spotify numbers and algorithms. It was just like, are your MySpace? Cool. Who's your top friend?
Yeah, post a bulletin now and again, some cryptic bulletin.
Yeah, some cryptic bulletin. But like, you'd all just like, you know, in a way, MySpace was like a beeper, like a pager, like in the 80s. Just like, we're going to be here. Okay, cool, we'll meet there. Like sometimes you'd like leave your phone at home. It's just like, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see where the night takes you, and there'd be like an amazing small club called Push Bar, run by this guy called Joe, and it was on Dean Street. And we'd all, after Frog, a lot of times we'd either go there or back to Nambuka. And then there's like a cool sort of scene started in Push Bar of, like, I think I started these nights called Young Turks with my friend Caius. And we did our first one at Sam Moritz, and then we started doing loads at the Push Bar. And it's just that small sort of shitty, like, sort of club that when you turn the lights on, you're like, how the fuck did I hang out in here for 6 hours? You like, it's like the lights have to be dark, and it's just like the sounds, it's loud, but it's just like a vibe. And no one really showed that they cared, but obviously they did care, because music was like the nucleus of the machine. It was keeping everything running. It's keeping us all interested.
Yeah, and it sounds like you put on a lot of good bands there at that club night. Am I right in thinking?
Yeah. I mean, Kaya sent me a poster the other day that had like Adele and like Florence the Machine on it. And
that's wild. And you put those gigs on?
Yeah, I don't remember. But yeah, I was definitely there. I mean, the one that I remember, because it's like, Kaius has an amazing memory as well, and he never really like drank that much, because he got diagnosed with diabetes at a really young age. But I sort of didn't drink till I moved to London, and I never drank beer. I thought I was really sophisticated and cool, I'd like smoke a cigarette and drink a Jack Daniels like in a glass. But then like when I started touring, that all went out, the sophistication all flew out the window. But yeah, like the one I really remember, I guess, is putting on Jamie T. And he would play a lot of our like after parties that we did, like a show at Nambuka. I remember he played, then we went to a bar down the road, and there was this place called Frank's Bar in Shoreditch. And I remember like Kid Harpoon and like Jamie playing there. And like another time for this, the guy that ran Frog, Tom's birthday, we did this big thing where like we had like the Holloways and a whole list of people that would do cover songs. And I remember doing it kind of tactfully, or coming up with the idea, because I really wanted to jam with Jamie, and it was quite hard to like pin down. And I knew he liked my band, because I'd give him my demo and he said that, and I liked his music. So I was like, oh, I'll do a song with Jamie. And then we became friends, and I ended up playing this band for like 4 years.
That's it. I must have seen you play then. I think we went to see them. Sorry, I went to see Jamie T and the Maccabees playing Sheffield around that time, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. The plug.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've seen you play.
Yeah. No, I remember that tour. That was a fun tour, because like I still speak and cross paths with the Maccabees guys quite a lot. I play football with Orlando's keyboard player, who makes music himself, this guy called Sammy, who's a genius. And yeah, I see Felix around.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
But yeah, that was one of the first tours. So
was that pretty mad then? Like, obviously people talk about like the first tours, and obviously, you know, he had a rapid rise to success, Jamie T, at that point. Was that all pretty mad at that point?
Well, the thing is, like, I always wanted to make my own music, and that's how I got in a scene. That's why I started putting on bands, to put on my own band. But like I said before, it was like I wasn't like evolved enough to sort of make the music I wanted to make.
Mm.
Like I always just want to make music that I want to listen to. But at the time, like it was weird, like joining a band, leaving the band that I'd moved to London with to join this band. And straight away, you're like Iron Maiden in a tour bus, having someone set up your guitar, like, no, I'll carry that. And you're just like, it was like the other way around.
Yeah.
It was almost like making a record and recording the drums last, you know? That's a really geeky analogy. But, yeah, we were like given a silver spoon straight away rather than working for it. Obviously, Jamie had worked for it. It was his thing. But for us and for me, I can only talk about myself personally. It was like the world was sort of the rock and roll, like holy grail was just sort of handed to you, being like, here you go, guys. Here's a passport. Do whatever you want. Don't die. you know, I wouldn't do anything differently. And it was like really fun.
Yeah, yeah. How many years were you doing that?
I think 5.
Oh, right. Okay.
From 2007. Yeah, to like 2012. Oh, yes. The last gig I played with Jamie was at Brixton Academy, or maybe some festival after that, but that's the last one I remember. And then I think everything kind of cooled down for him, and I was in like 4 or 5 bands at the time, so I just kept going. And then I started living in a studio with my partner at the time, and we broke up. And then I had like a crossroad of like, do you stay in the studio and pay like $2,000 a month and try and like push being a producer? Or do you find somewhere else to live or go back to your parents' house and like rethink your shit? And I decided to stay in the place and be a producer and like make money to pay for where I was living. And I was also doing club nights at the time, which paid for something. But like at the beginning of that time, I think it was 2016, I was in a band called Turbogeist and a band called Sugar. And Sugar were just breaking up, and Turbogeist was about to go on a tour of America for like the third time. And when I got back from America, I was just like, I'm just going to sit and just like try and like make the studio thing work. And I was getting really into writing, and on my off times, because, you know, when people leave, you're just at home and it's nighttime, and, you know, I was in like by Tower Bridge. There wasn't really like people around. I would just like start writing songs, and a lot of them became Atahualpa songs.
Right. Okay.
But I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just like sort of pouring it out. And yeah, like it was, you know, I missed touring. I will do it a hell of a lot differently now. Like I stopped drinking in 2018 and stopped taking drugs. And it's been really good. I like, you know, I don't get daunted by organizing myself. And I feel like my work ethic's gone up, but also I can hit it in my consciousness and my creativity a lot more. Back then it was just like get smashed and record something and hope that it's good the next day, but it usually like isn't, because you're so like, you know, when you get smashed, you're like, you're blocking shit out. And to be creative, you want to fucking hear everything on, you know, at the maximum level and just filter it through writing tunes or lyrics or whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, mentioned in your email about your band like Turbogeist and Sugar, and that record, you said you got signed in somewhere, but you felt like no one knew what to do with you. What did you mean by that?
I mean, maybe I'm being like having a blind spot, but what I've directly meant by that is that, like, yeah, okay, Sugar got signed to Love Love Love, which is a subsidiary of Universal, and they're like, we love what you do, let's put out a single. And we're like, great. And then they put out a single and they're like, what next? And like, we were just writing constantly, like me, Emma, and a bunch of other people, this guy Ben, we were just like recording, writing, jamming, but never really like, there was no direction or no one there to sort of develop it from an outside perspective. And when you're that age, I think that's really useful to have someone that you trust. Like, you know, the Beatles had George Martin, and you could argue that he's the fifth Beatle because he like made those records. But in those days, you had A&Rs. Do A&Rs still exist nowadays? I guess they do, but I still don't really know them. What do they do? No, I mean, I'm sure there are some great A&Rs, but we just didn't have that. And the same thing with Turbo Guys. It was the label did have an A&R, but I think you've got to want to do it. You've got to like sail the ship for them to sort of get behind you. And, you know, you've got to kind of give people a vibe to like get them to help you. And with Sugar, we were like really prolific, I think, in our writing. And, you know, during COVID, when we all had nothing to do, I went through all the Sugar stuff, and we've just released two songs that have been featured on two different movies. Because like they're great songs, and I feel like we have an album, but I just, it would have been really cool to have that. And I feel like if you're signing yourself to a label, you're giving them your music, you're giving them your masters, you're giving them some of your publishing, you're kind of signing a part of yourself away and a part of your future self away, songs you haven't written yet. So the least they can do is sort of channel what you're doing, what they've signed, to create an output. And that's what we didn't have.
Okay, yeah.
But I think like nowadays, again, I can only speak for myself. It's like the thing with putting out No Fools and just throwing it into the void, like that was the first thing that sort of created a domino effect of like, okay, I'm gonna like plan out an album. And that album turned into two EPs, my first two EPs, Spells and Patterns, which I released myself over a year. And I was gonna do another EP, but a lot of people were like, why don't you just do an album? And like my co-writer and producer, Matt Alchin, and just like my one of my best mates, like he was the best man at my wedding as well. And he had played in Ludes. I'd known him since, you know, I was going to those gigs when I was 17, but we never really started working together till 2018. He was like, yeah, he like pushed it. So in a way, we're like A&Ring ourselves. And I think that's really easy and natural and organic to do when you've known someone for almost 20 years and seen what they've done and they've seen what you do and you spend a lot of time together. Like, I think the problem that a lot of people have with A&Rs is it's like someone that you don't know just coming into your like safe space being like, okay, I think you should do this and I think you should do that and that song's shit and that song's great and you're the singer and, you know, you should wear your hair like that. And it's just like, oh, hang on a second, like, who invited you? But there's like a kind and like tender and thoughtful way to do it, and like I think only from hindsight I see that. I think at the time I wasn't thinking that at all. I was just like, let's just do what these people say and like play some shows. Like the only payoff from putting music out and being in the music industry is being able to like have a voice in your art and play shows. And the only time you don't have any limitations around what you're doing from outside people is when you're playing a show. You're free at that point. So that's kind of my whole life, my whole career, that's always been like the carrot at the end of the stick. It's like, I just want to play shows, like more shows, bigger shows, better shows, get better, write better songs to play bigger shows.
Yeah, yeah. Did he say Matt, did he mention that he was in Skaters? Is that right?
He was in Skaters.
With Josh,
yeah, yeah.
All right, okay.
So I think those guys met back in the Ludes days when Paddingtons were a thing, and they would just hang out in the same pub, I think. Right, this is a tiny bit before my time. But I first met Matt. I mean, I've met Josh a bunch of times, and I've worked with Tom from Paddington's.
And yeah, I thought I'd mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah, great guy and so fun to work with. But like with the whole thing with Matt was like, he was always there. like from the moment I like saw this thing happening in London, he was always there. And it was like a stars aligning thing. I'm going to sound like a hippie, but like, you know, we were always like pissed and like having fun and partying and falling over and laughing. A lot of falling over and laughing. And then like he had a studio because he'd just been working with, he'd been working with Florence the Machine. And since that started, he's had this studio. So he'd had it for like years. And then we kept bumping into each other and eventually and saying, yeah, we should, you should come to my studio. And I'd be like, you should come to my studio. And then eventually I just took him up on it and went to his studio and did this song Borrowed Time. And I was like really nervous and shy because I kind of thought like, you know, I looked up to him as a lot as like a guitarist and, you know, he's a really fun dude. But when you kind of put all that party front shit away, you're kind of two guys in a room sort of, and you're like opening up your soul to this guy. It's like really fucking personal. So I was a bit nervous, but he's like literally got like the best fucking energy. He's always hyped to do something. And after that experience of doing that first song, Borrowed Time, I was like, I got 9 other songs if you want to do that. And then that became the first 2 EPs. And then before we did the album, my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, she was, I met her when she was on set directing a movie and editing another movie. And I kept listening to what, I'm not going to say the name, but the guy that was doing the score before for this film, Sharpstick. And I would just like, I wouldn't hold back to say what I thought about it, let's say. And I kept like referencing like Brian Eno and Virgin Suicides and stuff. And eventually she was just like, do you just want to do it? You just do it. And me and Matt ended up doing that score. And that was the first like full length film we've done. We've scored like, you know, shorts and stuff before, but it was so fun that it just like upped our game for the Atahualpa album. And like, you know, with like string arrangements, the way I would like write drum parts with Matt and then bring it to our drummer, this guy, Hank, who's like fucking sick. I went to school with him and he went to like Berkeley and he's like one of those guys that was playing like jazz cafes when he was like 14 with like his new metal dreadlocks and shit. He was just like very naturally talented and he plays on all the records and all the scores and stuff. But like that experience of every time you go into the studio and do something a bit out of your comfort zone, you come out with like wiser and better. Mm-hmm. And like Matt, with anyone else, I don't know if that would be the case, but with Matt it is. And like every other experience of collaborating and making music with people is literally like, when it's 4 dudes in the room, it's just like a fight. You're just like arguing. And it's like a collaboration isn't about getting your point across. It's about coming up with a better thing than all your parts combined. And like I didn't really get that until 2018 when I stopped drinking and started working with Matt Ulchin.
Is that like, yeah, is that writing scores for movies and stuff, is that almost a more sustainable career for musicians now or not really in terms of like finances?
I mean, it depends what scores. And making music's really expensive. And it's like, I think you have to put a lot into it before you get anything out of it, unless you're super lucky. But yeah, I guess like, if you think about it from a logical sense, there's 100,000 songs are uploaded to Spotify every day. And we all know what the streaming rate is for our musicians. It's basically zero. You're basically giving it away for free. That's the way I see it. And like how many production companies are there and how many streaming platforms are there for movies and films and TV shows? You know, it's like there's a lot of music to be made in those shows. So yeah, I guess so. But again, it's like from my personal experience, it's all about like the hustle and like getting there. And like, just because we've made, you know, these two scores for like my wife, it doesn't mean we're like in the door. It's like you just kind of carry on like meeting people and talking about things. And I don't think people like, unless you're like Hans Zimmer, I don't think people like book you just because of your work. They kind of, you kind of want to meet them, and you kind of want to like make sure that, you know, you're going on this journey with them. It's like, it's not about just handing a CV. It's kind of, I don't know. It's, I don't know, to answer your question. I think music's like a tough one. And have you seen Meet Me in the Bathroom?
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't you see it as like a red flag for like the music industry?
In what respect?
In the respect that every, that shows all the bands there when they're like mates and they're young and they're having a good time. And then there's that point in the film where like the girl from Moldy Peaches says that the last time I saw Julian Casablancas was like at one of their last, at a really big Strokes show, and Courtney Love was there. And she said like, come with us, be famous with us. And Julian Casablancas was like, I want to stay here. And that was the last time she saw him, and they were like best friends. And then like, everything kind of went wrong. Like Albert Hammond Jr. had the whole like George Harrison thing of like wanting to play, wanting to do his songs. And everyone was like, no, it's not about that. And like the moment that money and a, like a business vision, like this works, so don't go out of this. And if you do, you'll fail and we'll take everything, or we'll take your house. It's like kind of sucks the soul of the creativity out of it. And also like all the friendships kind of like dissolved after that.
It's yeah, like, yeah.
It kind of, I don't know, it made me feel really like, it was kind of just like sad, I guess. Because it,
what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, because it was like so exciting at first. But then it's also like, that's what everything is. Everything comes in cycles, and things, everything that comes up must come down. But it's like, these were guys that like, just loved hanging out together and making music. And like the same thing with the, with Karenow and Yeah Yeah Yeahs. It was like they have to sort of prove themselves by like walking through this fire, and like the longest you can last without saying shit, guys, we're in a fire, like the more like the industry will like pat you on the head. And I just felt like, you know, the Moldy Peaches are playing this year as well, and they didn't have to go through all that shit. Like, I wonder what their experiences are. And it's interesting how they mentioned the White Stripes a lot in that film, but they never got interviewed. But like, I don't know. I think like the reason I, the thing that I've seen with doing music is like, of course you have all those dreams of getting that when you're younger, but in a way I'm like so into the direction that I've gone in, where I can just like make what I want to make and put it out in the world. And if people like it, great. And if not, then I'll just make something else. But like, I never put something out that I don't like, or just because like the thing before did well, so I'll do that again, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, I thought one of the most interesting bits of the film was the stroke going into the second album. Like,
yeah,
just how much it affected like Julian Casablancas. It was wild. Like, it's like the turmoil he was putting himself through.
Yeah. I mean, it was beautiful when he was like, I just realized that everyone wants to be creative and I should like give them that. And it's like, if you wrote an album by yourself and it's this, is this it? It's like, that's fucking enough. Like, you know, but not for the industry and not for those MTV pressures of the noughties. And yeah, I think nowadays it's sort of translated into number pressures, which is a lot less like fabulous looking, you know. It's just like numbers on a screen, rather than falling asleep in a bed live on MTV with Courtney Love chatting shit with Ryan Adams.
Yeah, I think there's one quote from Julian, he's like, the interview is like why are you being so hard on yourself? He's just like, I just don't want to let people down. And I guess when you're writing every bit of every song, it must be fucking mad with that kind of expectation.
I mean, James Murphy's a really good example of that.
Mm.
Like, Julian Casablancas was like this guy, but behind that, he's a James Murphy. He's a perfectionist. He wants everything to be perfect. He doesn't like sending emails.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod.
We actually, TurboQuest actually played a show with LCD Sound System. We supported them in Sao Paulo.
Oh, wow.
And it was like playing in South America is like the greatest pleasure a band can have, because no one knew us. Well, I felt like no one knew us here, really. But then you go there and you play to like thousands of people, and the whole front row is like singing your songs, because they just like, that's the beauty of the internet, you know, you just Google it and listen to the song. And they were amazing. Like, I remember just watching their sound check and being like, their sound check sounds like better than the record. And then the show was incredible. I'd never seen them before. I never really got into them that much. I'd obviously heard like the singles and stuff, but I got into them quite a lot after that. It's like very like White Album, Beatles-y, a lot of their stuff, which I love. But then like James Murphy DJ'd after the show, and it was one of the best DJ sets I've ever seen. Like, he knows his shit.
Yeah, quality. Yeah, there's a bit in the film on that where he was like, there's a point where people were just downloading all these songs, whereas he'd had to like go out and search for them for years.
Kind of thing. Wasted the last 30 years of my life.
Yeah, that's quite funny.
Quite funny. And then like the whole William Orbit bit was genius. And like just the way that the Rapture's first record was with those guys. And it's like they literally made them record live. And you're like, yeah, we're finally doing it. And then he's like, then we took all of it apart and put it back together again. It's like how, like, oh, it made me feel like nauseous and anxious that bit for them. But like, I mean, the album's amazing, but you know, they should have been told to like, you know, go on holiday while we do this. Like, don't sit behind us, like breathing on us.
Yeah. The relationship between him and Luke Jenner sounded pretty fascinating.
The what?
The relationship between James Murphy and Luke and the Rapture sounds pretty fascinating, just in like how much he'd push him kind of thing, yeah.
I mean, that's the job of a producer in a lot of ways. You know, back to the George Martin thing. Just listen to the first Beatles recordings compared to like, you know, Abbey Road. It's like the ultimate push, and you know, just being able to maneuver all those characters and to make people like happy enough to carry on to turn up the next day, you know. It's like, it's kind of an amazing job, but you are like a director, you're a puppet master. But then the puppet master is going to bring in results, it's going to make the band think, fuck, this is like worth it.
Yeah that is a fascinating role.
Yeah.
Would you call yourself a producer? Is that what you've done? Like, do you have to know how to get the best out of people kind of thing?
I did it for like 5 years, like every day. And I really enjoyed it. But once you've done your job and it's, you know, you've sent everything back and the label has it or the artist has it, then it's kind of out of your hands. And there's like a lot of freedom to that. But like I said, I am a bit of a James Murphy myself. Like, I like making music to be able to perform it and to be able to release it into the world. And once it's like gone, there's sort of like a, it leaves like a bit of a void. So I always liked, I still produce now. To answer your question, yes. And like I tried to be involved with like the writing and the playing as much as possible. But I wouldn't say that's my first thing. I'm, you know, my first thing is Atahualpa in this album I've just released.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like, yeah, that's kind of my calling card. But, you know, I'm not going to, back in those days, you could just be like, I'm in a band and that's it. I play guitar in this band, that's it. But now, you know, you have to hustle. You have to do loads of different things. And yeah, I think the whole, like, not smoking weed, not drinking thing has given me this sort of, not an edge, but like a frequency of just like wanting to do more all the time. And like Matt and like my band members always sort of comment on that quite a lot. I don't know if it's like a backhanded compliment of being like, you're a fucking slave driver, or like, you know, you do a lot, but I always feel like I could do more.
Yeah, and I can imagine, you know, even with this podcast, it's hard for me to like, you know, once I've recorded an episode, it's hard for me to just leave it. Like, I want to get straight into it and like see like some finished results. So I've had to learn to be a bit better with that. And because once you give it a bit of space, it's always a bit beneficial kind of thing.
Yeah, and you start kind of, it's that whole thing with art is like a true artist can tell when something is finished. And it's like, if you leave it for too long, you're going to start critiquing bits. You're going to want to like edit things. But if you just like are in it, you're in it. It's just like, that's great. Let's put it out. Next one. You get into the flow. But when you start questioning yourself, that's when like, you know, you start blocking up. But yeah, I mean, you guys have done a, is it just you that does this podcast?
Or
is it?
Yeah. So, well, yeah, basically. Yeah.
It's your baby.
Yeah. And Tom jumped on it for a while. And then he, you know, he's doing his own stuff, basically, like the music he did with you and stuff like that. So yeah. I've just carried it on. But I'm sure I'll be back someday.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. People come and go, and it's not really sounds like such a harsh thing to say, but it's not about people. It's about the thing.
Mm.
And like, if the thing runs out of juice, then you do something else. But I think yeah. It's like really, it's really cool what you've done. And you put out so much, man. I'm like, it's definitely filled up a lot of my empty nights.
Cheers, mate. Yeah, it's been a real passion project. Yeah, it's like, it seems to be like on a, I've started like staggering episodes now, because like before I was just recording and firing them out. So sometimes you get like four a month, but now I'm kind of like staggering out a bit. So it's got a bit more of a lifespan.
Yeah. I mean, as long as you enjoy it and you're really good at it.
Oh, cheers, mate.
Yeah, it's definitely an art, like interviewing and talking to people and understanding it. And also like doing all the social stuff, like putting it out. It's the whole thing. No, it's really cool, man. And nice. Yeah, thanks for having me as well.
Cheers for coming on. Going back to the movie stuff, I did want to ask you about this thing I saw on your Wikipedia about writing a song with Mick Jagger for the series Vinyl, because I remember watching that series. I really enjoyed it, but I think it was only one series or something.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I think it got like a lot of criticism, didn't it? I don't know why.
I mean, I'll give you my criticism.
Go on then. Yeah, yeah.
I love the Elvis episode.
Right, yeah.
I thought it was a standalone thing, you know, when he goes to Vegas and he tries to sign Elvis, but like the Colonel, Elvis's manager, is just like drugging Elvis and not like, it's like gave you like this, I didn't know anything about that really.
Mm.
And obviously that Baz Luhrmann Elvis film just came out and it says it all, it's a film from the Colonel's perspective. But yeah, that was sort of towards the end of the Turbo Guys run. We're in a rehearsal space, probably rehearsing or talking about rehearsing. And then Jimmy, who is Mick's son, was like, oh, I forgot something really cool. Like, my dad wants us to, he's producing a show with Martin Scorsese, and he wants us to do a couple of songs for it in the style of like Dead Boys or Iggy Pop, because it's a show about, it's a show about the New York punk scene and A&Rs. And I was like, in my head, you know, we spoke about it, and in my head I was like, cool, this is going to be like 24-hour, like New York's answer to 24-hour Party People. And I still think to this day, like 24-hour Party People is like one of the best biopics ever made, like especially the way that the live music's shown. But I guess I kind of sort of blocked out the fact that he said Martin Scorsese, because it's quite a lot of information to process. You're like 25 or whatever in a rehearsal space in like East London at 10 at night. But we were like, cool, cool. And he was like, yeah, but the thing is, we had to send it tomorrow.
Wow.
I was like, oh, shit. And that was like very much the energy of our band. Like, we're kind of stoners. And but this was great. So we're like, we're in a space. I fucking love the Dead Boys. I think, what's the song? Ain't It Fun? Like, when I first heard the Paddingtons, I was like, Tom reminded me of Stiff Baiters, and I just thought, I just heard Rocket from the Tombs, Dead Boys, Ain't It Fun. I just thought, I think that song's like a fucking anthem. But anyway, I was like, this is a really cool thing. So we sat around, we obviously wrote a song that was nowhere near as good as Ain't It Fun, but we recorded it on like two phones. And I took it back to my studio in London, in Tower Bridge, and we recorded a bass on it. And then sent it and kind of forgot about it for 3 months. And I was in the studio and I got a phone call from Jimmy, and I picked up and I just heard this voice going, Jimmy, do you reckon get Lewis to like add a guitar part so I can go, New York's good if you want to fight? And I was literally like, what the fuck? Like, I just burst out laughing. And and Jimmy was like, so do I need to did you hear what my old man said? Don't you repeat what he said? And I was like, no, like I got it. So I like recorded some guitar, sent it off. And then Mick and Jimmy wrote the lyrics and did the vocals. And then the show was made. And like Ray Ronaldo from, is that his name? Ray Ronaldo from Sonic Youth. He like redid all the music and packaged it. So he was like the producer, kind of like me and Matt were on Birdie. He was the producer on vinyl and got all the musicians together and played, you know, he was playing my guitar parts, which is pretty cool. And that was it. And like, you know, we back and forthed a couple of emails about that guitar part, and that was it. And we had two songs in it. One song was the Turbo Guy song that we just hadn't used. And yeah, that song, I think it was called Rotting Apple or something, was on the first episode, the Scorsese directed one. And like classic, like me in my 20s, I tried to push my luck by trying to get in the show.
Right, yes.
And I like sent them a picture. I'd just done these photos with my band Sugar where we're like, I was wearing what Emma wears and she was wearing what I wear. I had a leather jacket and she was wearing like a sort of bra. And I sent those in and they're like, yeah, I got a call from their casting agent. They're like, yeah, I really like your look. Like, let's do this. We'll get you in like an extra. And I was like, sick. But then they're like, do you have an acting visa? And I was like, no, I'm a musician. Isn't it the same thing? And they're like, no. And they're like, we can only pay you $100 a day and it'd be 3 days, but a visa costs like $1,000.
Right.
I wasn't prepared to like pay to play.
Yeah.
Even though it would have been an experience, but like, I liked the initial idea of that show, but like, you know, like I said before, I sort of blocked out the fact that Martin Scorsese was doing it. There's always got to be a dead body showing up, isn't there, in a Martin Scorsese film? It can't just be about the music and what it was like to be an A&R in those days and how much coke they did, you know?
Yeah.
To be like, oh, and there was a murder, and then they're involved. And
the storyline's coming back to me now. Yeah, he killed someone, didn't he, the main guy?
He killed someone in like the first episode.
Yeah.
And it's like, if I was Martin, which I know I'm not, I'd have done that at the end of episode 10, and just made the whole thing about, you know, it's such a rich subject, you know? But it was cool to be involved. And that was like, I think that was just before that last American tour with Turbo Geist when we recorded that. But yeah, cool. It was fun.
And yeah, just going back to some stuff you sent, just about music now, like if you said you feel like posting and creating content might be a waste of time with the internet. And yeah,
that's
just like dig into that maybe, yeah.
That's a hopeful statement. I don't know, like, how do you feel about all that? How do you consume music these days?
Yeah, it's just like new music. Probably the most sure way for me would be listening to Release Radar on Spotify, which is, I don't know, not the most romantic way, is it?
But, well, it's better than following like dance trends on TikTok and getting 10-second snippets and following, and they're getting into music like that.
Yeah, like when people say, people talk about,
I wouldn't judge you if you have a whole dancing TikTok, you know, I think that'd be fucking pretty cool actually. But
when people say record labels are following what's kicking off on TikTok, I'm like, how does that work then? So it's just clips of music, of songs, is it?
I mean, I haven't really trusted what people at record labels say for a long time. So that to me sounds a bit like a diffusion or like a procrastination to like getting yourself down to a gig or to a rehearsal space or to someone's house to listen to some music.
Mm.
But yeah, no, I'm being like small-minded. That is a thing.
Right.
TikTok has become the biggest, the most used search engine over Google, like in the last sort of few months or year or whatever, because the young generation search stuff on TikTok, which is whatever it is, you know, when you're young, you use whatever tools you have to express yourself and to like feel alive and to be present. But like I think there's a lot of problems that come up with that, because a lot of stuff that's put on TikTok is generally negative experiences, you know. Like I was talking to my friend the other day who works at a school and sort of gives advice to kids to go to when they want to go to university, you know, kids that don't really know much about it but like are interested, and a lot of them apparently say, but on TikTok I've seen that these people have had really bad experiences, because like the way the algorithm works is it pushes the most like watchable thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's usually a negative experience. You never see like good news on the front page of the Daily Mail, do you? It's all negativity, bad news sells, sadly. And I think that's problematic. And in the case of music, yeah, like, you know, a lot of people find expression on TikTok. And people do that. People do dances. People do talks. People vent, which is like, you know, it's amazing to have a platform like that. And then the way that people discover music, I imagine, is by the music being in the background or part of the video that they're creating. But which is like, you know, we thought our generation, like going back to the movie, the Meet Me in the Bathroom, we thought that Napster was like a bit of a fork in the road, or, you know, but this is just like, if that's a fork, this is just like, I don't know, a teaspoon down the road in a building you never knew even existed.
Mm.
And it's just like, okay, but I don't think it's about understanding it or knowing it or like seeing the whole like blueprint of it, because it will change. I feel like it will change. A lot of people that are smarter than me have said that this is here to stay for a while, and they give me that like Google search engine example, but it's like the world changes so quickly, and like music's always going to be there, but the way we consume it's going to change. So like, you know, bring it on. But I don't think I'm going to start like dedicating my time to that, or even like Instagram or Facebook. It's just the more music I make, the less I want to do that, honestly.
Hmm. Yeah, because, yeah, I don't know. It's a lot of time's dedicated to, you know, bands or artists like posting on online. Whereas, like, we've talked about before, like, there's a lot of mystery. It's like this mystery element to bands back in the day that would get you hooked. Whereas now it's like the opposite, like, you know, this thing of like pushing more and more out in a way. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's so like full. Like the internet is just so full of people talking. It's like everyone's just talking at the same time and saying things that what the music industry is telling artists to do is just it's full. So like just add more.
Mm.
Let's just see what happens when it overruns, when the glass is totally full, because we don't know what else to do.
Mm.
And it's like the way I'm doing it, or I've been doing it, it's just like gradually putting more music out and gradually playing more shows. And yeah, I've seen some numbers go up, some numbers go down, but that's kind of what numbers do, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Are you at a point now where you just want to be true to yourself, whether that's well received by people or not? Like just try and be like just genuine about what you're doing, I suppose.
I have to be like in the music's what I have full control over, but I have a lot of voices. Outside voices and voice, you know, I said this to my therapist the other day. I was like, oh, there's this guy that really wants to help me, but he said that I have to like make 3 videos a day and nothing to do with music, just like in a rehearsal. And he's like, yeah, just show people what you're doing. And I'm like, that's really intrusive. And my therapist was just like, oh, that's great. And I was like, oh. So it's all in my head, the fact that like no one cares anymore. Privacy is like a myth. It's like to sell your single, to get your music out there, to get people interested in the second record, the industry thinks that you have to sort of entertain from this other direction. That's not what we do. And it's like, I am a bit on the fence about that, but like, in a way, can we make it fun? I feel like if I'm in a studio, the last thing I want to really be doing is like filming someone doing something. I want to be like present.
Mm.
That gets rid of my presence.
Yeah, definitely. I don't.
But are we evolving to the point where like that's not the case? Because there's so much negative about that. But maybe we're. I think that because I'm just from a generation didn't have that when I was a kid.
Yeah. I'd prefer people to hold things back and like keep you wanting more, I suppose. I don't know. But maybe that's a bit too vague.
No, I think like with music, you can do that.
Mm.
But I'm talking about silly videos.
Yeah, but even in terms of that, like...
Like the Rolling Stones just did a started a TikTok the other day.
God.
And it's like, it's some Black Mirror shit.
Yeah, yeah. You need things to keep you intrigued. You don't need everything laid out all the time. I don't know.
Well, I think you've probably got a quite good attention span from what you do.
Mm.
And just the way, you know, your nature. But I think attention spans are getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely like find myself, even if I'm watching something on TV, it's really hard not to pick up my phone every 5 minutes, which is like...
I have to leave it on the other side of the room if I don't want to do that.
Even if it's a show I'm really into.
And then I'm like this, I'm like, oh, it's not there, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a ghost limb.
I've been watching Last of Us and I'm really into it, but at the same time,
I just
keep finding myself picking up. I have to, like you say, I have to put it somewhere else and just
last episode this or Monday.
Yeah, yeah.
In America. Yeah, I worked with Bella Ramsey from Last of Us.
Oh, really?
Amazing. She was in Catherine Called Birdie, which is the movie that me and Matt did the soundtrack, produced the soundtrack for. And we produced one of her songs. And it was so fun. I met her when she was filming and just sort of Lena was like, oh, Bella plays some songs, like maybe you guys should meet and work together. And I had the idea of like doing an EP or something. And then she played me this song, two songs, but one of them had a chorus about letting her wings. What is it? Something about wings and flying. Can't remember straight away what the lyric was. And we just sort of glued these ideas together and that song ended up on the soundtrack and in the film.
Oh, cool.
And it's so cool. And like, she's like, they say she's an old soul, but like, she's so cool. And her lyrics are just so deep, but funny. It's got that Moldy Peaches thing of like, it makes you laugh, but it also makes you think. And it's also quite cozy and sweet, like her. But she's a genius, and I'm so blown away by that show. Like that last episode, I was literally like, I felt like a kid in a Marvel movie, like just screaming at the screen, like, fucking get him. When she breaks his fingers and like, tell them I broke your fucking fingers.
Yeah, it's ass, yeah.
They're so cool together, those two. But I don't want it to end. It's one of those shows.
Whenever I watched
that Walking Dead, I always wanted it to end because it was just like grim and sad. You know,
I never watched that one.
It's really good. The first two seasons are amazing. I used to read the comic. I read the graphic novels or comic books. Biggest selling black and white comic book ever, Walking Dead.
Oh, right. Good.
And then it became the biggest show in America. But yeah, it was like just, there wasn't any sort of love or hope in sight. It was just grim, like hyper real, like, okay, this is fucked. But yeah, in this, it's just like, they've made it, they've kind of somehow thrown in like really emotional side to it. Like that episode 3 with Nick Offerman and the guy from White Lotus, that was like, made me cry. Like I cried a lot from that episode. And I never thought I'd cry from like a zombie, you know, something that is really at the heart of it. It's like a zombie show.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm going to have to, when I finish the series, I'm going to start watching people play the game on Twitch, I think. Can be a bit of extra content.
Okay, see, there we are with the extra content.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like, it's like the way I think about it, I am trying to change the way that my mind works of thinking like, that's not for me. I'm not going to do that because the rest of the world are doing it. And when iPhones first came out, I was like, what, iPod on your phone? Are you fucking crazy? That's not going to catch on. And it's like, come on, you just got to sort of get with it. So I'm trying to change my brain to it. And it's like, whenever I'm scrolling, you know, look at my Instagram search thing is like pictures of Liam Gallagher, Kurt Cobain, raccoons and cats. That's the general vibe. And it's like, okay, so I'm doing it. I'm part of the problem. So like, let's have fun with it. But I haven't quite found the like, hole through the needle to like have fun with it yet. I'll let you know if I do.
Cheers, mate. Yeah. It's interesting because I've got like a 3-year-old now, so it's interesting how
cute. What's her name?
It's a boy, he's called Rory, but like, he's at the instant stage now where he's obviously not interested. Well, he's just got his own tablet, which is a bit weird. But
like one of those baby ones.
Yeah, the Amazon ones, yeah.
He's not like on Wikipedia.
Nah, so it's just going to be interesting how he like kind of, you know, accesses stuff as he gets older, like how he goes about it. Be interesting to see. Probably quite stressful at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you're right at the eye of the storm there, seeing it through your son's eyes. Like, literally, that's interesting, though. I mean, yeah, it's just where it's all going so fast. Like, life just goes by so fucking fast. Like, just looking at that, watching that film yesterday, thinking what I was doing, talking to you, thinking of what I was doing or what I was like when I was 18. It's just like it goes, and hopefully something constructive sinks in so you don't just end up in a void of sadness and woe when you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s and onwards.
All right, Matt, I've got to set off for football soon, so
Cool.
But yeah, so in terms of this new music, then, have you been playing live? Like, what's the plan?
Yeah. We've been playing like a show a month in London, because I'm writing at the moment, and it's just like, before, when I wrote the first two EPs and album, I didn't have a band, and now we have a band, and it's just like so like cool to be able to try out ideas with like human beings. So we've been playing these shows, and we did a few shows which was just the album present, like at the end of last year and at the beginning of this year. And now those songs are just in the set list, but we have like four or five brand new songs every show that we're sort of testing out. And then this summer, playing some festivals. And yeah, like just hoping to get a good support tour this year. Because I really think that like the band really becomes fluid or solidified or whatever way you want to look at it, comes into itself when you're playing every night for a specific amount of time. But yeah, I'm really enjoying playing these like London shows though. And
where are you playing them?
We're playing at Biddle Bros in Clapton on the 18th. Okay. So a week today. And it's for this North London homelessness charity. And it's like an all-dayer. Bands like Human Interest are playing, and Video Blue, and a bunch of record shops from the area are like helping putting it on and DJing throughout the day from like 2. But we're on it like, we're finishing it off around 9. And then we're playing Dash the Henge Record Shop in Camberwell New Road on April 22nd. And that will be like, it's a great new record shop that's opened. And even though I've just released my album, I haven't released it on vinyl, because I would rather spend that money on content, on making music videos and like, you know, a radio plug here and there or whatever, you know. Like, I just feel like I want to build something up before I make it physical. But I'd love to make something physical, because I feel like we need to leave something behind for the aliens. They're not going to be logging into our Spotify accounts when we're all gone. But and then, yeah, in the summer, we'll probably do another show at the Ivy House. We played one last month. And there's some really cool bands at the moment that I want to play with. I've got like a list of like 10 bands. A band called Sunken, a band called Pencil, this guy called Alex Irene, this guy called, wait, I'm going to get my list. James Howard, Wednesday's Child, Sweet Girls. There's just like a cool sort of bunch of bands bubbling up, and they're all like guitar bands and like, you know, making guitar music weird again, which is interesting and fun. And you know, I just released a single with Misty Miller, who's a great singer and songwriter. And she's played with us a bunch of times. But, and she did sung the vocals on the soundtrack we did for Birdie on a lot of the covers. But yeah, like at the moment, I'm just doing this once a month thing and trying to sort of, for lack of a better word, just like manifest a tour. Which we do as a support tour, because we can't really do a headline tour at the moment. That'd be a lot of work for me. That's like a whole job to set that up.
Mm-hmm.
I was thought about doing it at the end of last year, and then I kind of saw the size of the workload that goes into it. And yeah, nah, not doing that.
Yeah, fair play, mate. And it's just Atahualpa on all the channels.
Atahualpa on all the channels. And yeah, I mean, just listen to the album Presence. And if you like it, then go backwards, I'd say, because that's the latest thing. And I feel like that album is, you know, it's me sort of realizing that I can do this and like wanting to do it and prepared to do it. And the next album sounding a bit more, it's going to be like more of a band and a bit more lively. But yeah.
Yes, mate. I've been enjoying it.
Thank you. And also I'd make music videos for like, for everything. I don't know why I fucking went kind of mad during COVID and made a music video for every song on the first two EPs. And then there's 5 music videos for the album and there's 10 songs on it. And well, technically 7 videos, 2 alive. So yeah, it's like, I kind of love that. As an MTV kid, I kind of feel like you're not really a band unless you got a cool music video.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of like getting stuff out there, I know like you helped Tom. He was trying to explain to me what he was doing in terms of like working with like distribution people and stuff like that. So it's all kind of separate kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I've got a little label, but it's like very much online distribution. Who knows what it'll grow into in the future. I'm not like wanting to be the next Ian McKay. Like, I don't want to start a record label right now. But yeah, it's called Atahualpa Records. And a lot of things that I've done in the past, like with Tom, we put out his EP. I put out a Sugar record. I put out another band called Nerves, NRVS. They just put out a song called Scum, which is, sounds, yeah, it's pretty cool. And the visuals are good. They're like an anonymous anonymous 3-piece from London. And all their artwork is just like, it's kind of like a Gorillaz, like a punked up Gorillaz, but you just don't really know who they are. One of them was in like Extinction Rebellion and was recently imprisoned for, you know, being an environmentalist. So I don't think he or she likes the idea of their name being like all over the internet, like in a band, you know, because the police will find them. But right. Yeah, check out Nerves, they're cool. Really fun to work with them, great lyrics. And it's like that whole punk thing, which I enjoy, but I don't really, I used to scream on stage all the time and I'm not like, that's not my thing anymore. But like, I like when people do it. And then, yeah, put out these 2 Sugar songs. And like, literally, like, if you came up to me and were like, I've got this song, I don't really know what to do with it, you know, I'd give people advice. And then if they can't find anywhere else to do it, I'll just do it for them.
Yes.
But because that's, you know, what I would have liked when I was in that position. But yeah, man. I mean, I love to come up. You're in Manchester. Are you whereabouts are you?
Yeah, Manchester, yeah.
Manchester. Yeah, I'd love to come up and play there. I've been talking to a couple of promoters about going up to Manchester and playing. There's like some Tom Priest, who runs a magazine called Yuck that's been really good to us.
Okay.
And they're based in Manchester. I think they used to do stuff at Night and Day.
Right, right, yeah.
I don't know if Night and Day is still around, but I heard it might have been closing down, but maybe not. Hopefully not. It's a cool venue. But yeah, I want to go and do something with them and play up there. And like I said, like, you know, I wouldn't be able to get this stuff out and do it or have the confidence to if it wasn't for like these independent blogs and people like yourself, you know, that like actually listen and you're not just scrolling like TikTok videos, you're actually like looking for something with, you know, I mean, maybe I'm being too harsh on these TikTokers.
No, it's fair. I mean, I could definitely, I ignore 6 Music too much. I need to listen to that more, I think, but
yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to get to played on 6 Music at the moment. Steve Lamacq played us, Tom Robinson played us, but it's just like, it's hard. Like it's a cool station.
Yeah. I feel like when I listen to it, I'll hear at least like one or two songs that I've not heard before that are really cool. But
isn't it interesting how hard it is to like turn the radio on when you just got Spotify?
Yeah.
It's kind of like it numbs that part of your brain wanting to listen to the radio and wanting to hear someone talking. Cause like,
it's that almost you want to be more in control of what content you're taking in. Like, you know, I don't know.
Also listening to albums. Like I find Spotify, it's like I will get in my car and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to listen to albums. And I just listen to a playlist because it just takes me on a journey and I like forget to listen to the album.
It's
too comfortable in a way. Too easy.
That's it, yeah. You get in a comfort zone, don't you?
Yeah. And like with Six Music, you have to do like a bit of work and maybe you don't like one of the songs and you have to get through it. And it's just like, but still that's kind of, it shouldn't be that easy, but it's really... it's a comfortable place to be in.
Yeah.